From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Senator Debbie Stabenow on why she's joining the calls for President Trump's removal from office.
So I think she's a danger.
Then we get a historical perspective on the transfer of power that's happening right now.
The behavior we saw a couple of days ago on Wednesday was the single most disruptive presidential act in U.S. history.
And we'll talk about the legacy of Betsy DeVos as education secretary. She's resigning weeks before the inauguration.
But what we witnessed this week was somebody that had created an environment that now has a body count. And no doubt in reading the secretary's letter that was weighing heavily upon her mind.
You know, the teacher union head last night when news broke tweeted two words in response to the resignation: good riddance.
All that's coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's Betsy DeVos announced last night she's resigning as U.S. Secretary of Education.
When you're in a cabinet, you work for the president. It's part of your job. You don't always agree with everything. But what we witnessed this week was somebody that had created an environment that now has a body count.
Later in the show, we'll talk about DeVos's legacy and what's going on in the cabinet right now. But first, the U.S. Senate is waiting for certification of election results for its two newest members. This week's victories in Georgia for Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff mean a shift of power for a body that has in recent years become a more polarized version of its temperate self. This is going to mean changes for Michigan's senior senator. Democrat Debbie Stabenow joins us by phone today from Washington, D.C. Senator, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be with you, April.
What an extraordinary week this has been. How are you and your staff doing?
No, we're fine. It was frightening this week, and at the same time, really heartbreaking. I came into the Senate in 2001 and lived through 9/11, being in Washington during the attacks and so on, and which was the only other time I really felt threatened in terms of, physically threatened in D.C. But it was very different because those were foreign terrorists. And so at the time, we were all frightened, but angry and focused on, standing up for our country and so on. This is very different feeling because we're talking about Americans who were part of a mob that were literally doing their best to take over the Capitol in the name of what they said was their revolution, their Independence Day, and they were incited by this, and this insurrection came because of the President of the United States. So very different.
Senator, you told NPR today that President Trump should be removed from office before Inauguration Day. I'm wondering what you're hearing from your colleagues. Do you think the Senate could be ready to remove him if there is a House impeachment vote next week, or if the cabinet invokes the 25th Amendment before that point?
Well, the reason I believe that he should be removed is because I don't believe there's any limits on what he would do to respond to his own emotions, his own sense of grievance, or wanting to demonstrate his own power. And so I think he's a danger. And the 25th Amendment would be the way this should happen. I mean, it's interesting. We see members of the cabinet leaving. You mentioned Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. It would be better if she stayed and worked with the Vice President to pass a letter if the majority of the cabinet joined with the Vice President in a letter indicating they believe the President is no longer fit, then the Vice President would take over and be involved in peaceful transfer of power. And that is just a much more responsible and frankly safer thing for Americans right now.
But do you think the votes are there in the Senate if it came to a removal from office?
Well, the 25th Amendment doesn't require a vote in the Senate, which is why that would be the best, because that's simply a majority of the cabinet and the Vice President putting together a letter that they send to the Speaker and President pro tem in the Senate. When it comes to impeachment, I certainly think the vote will be there in the House and possibly bipartisan votes. It is much more difficult in the Senate. So it's difficult to say what would happen there. I think the challenge for us, and we know there's a limited amount of time right now, but the question is accountability. I mean, but we have a president who incited mobs and riots, and we had a Capitol police officer who lost his life. We had four other people who lost their lives. This is, you know, against the law. This is a criminal behavior. And so there has to be some way to express that and also let the world know that this is not who we are as Americans, and that we in America are not going to tolerate those who are trying to basically overturn our government, which is what they were trying to do. And people lost their lives in the process.
Let's move on to the business of the next administration. Have you seen any signs that Joe Biden will have any cabinet nominees confirmed by the time he takes office? Traditionally, the Senate moves on cabinet nominations relatively quickly, but things being things right now, would the new Senate majority take effect in time to vote on those? Or is this in the hands of Majority Leader McConnell?
Well, this is what we're trying right now to work through. I believe that Georgia races are actually certified, I believe, on the 15th. And so then the question becomes, you know, the transferring the majority position from Senator McConnell to Senator Schumer and so on. And so right now we're reaching across with colleagues across the aisle to try to get some hearings going, whether that's next week or the day before the swearing-in on the 20th. It's so important that key positions be filled. I remember that under President Trump, the day of the inaugural, we came in the morning and voted on the Secretary of Defense because it was critical that we have a Secretary of Defense. And so I would hope we would get the same courtesy in working with this new administration and all of us. We need a Treasury Secretary. We need our national security people. We need to move as quickly as possible on all of our appointments. And certainly given what we are seeing now about the homegrown violence, we need our Secretary of Homeland Security.
In 2021, you will be in line to chair the Senate Agriculture Committee. And you have said that one top priority you have is working on a carbon market, that is, creating a voluntary climate exchange. I want to ask you about another priority area that the committee has jurisdiction over, and that's food stamps. What can the committee do to help the families that are in extreme need of food aid this year?
Well, that is also one of my top priorities. Basically, my top two priorities relate to food security for people, for children, for families, for seniors, and working with our growers to help them get the front of the line to tackle the carbon crisis through a voluntary carbon exchange, so which I think is very exciting. We've already begun, I negotiated the successful effort to increase what we call SNAP. That used to be called food stamps. It's now Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. And I was able to get an increase in SNAP benefits through the end of June. And most of the things that we passed in the COVID package, there was only agreement to go through mid-March, but I was successful in getting this through the end of June. We certainly need that to go longer as well, but that was a good first step because for a year I could not get bipartisan support to do this. So we finally were able to do that. So we need both to be extending the availability for people of food. And by the way, one of the best economic stimulus is to provide a dollar in SNAP benefits because someone has to go to the grocery store. And the economists tell us that it turns $1.70 over in the economy. So the grocery store, the processor, the truckers, the farmers, you know, when people have money to buy food, it's a winner for everybody. So I'm going to continue to focus on that, as well as incentives for fresh fruits and vegetables. I started in the back in 2014 in the five-year farm bill that I wrote, a pilot project based on Michigan called Double Up Bucks. If you went to the if you went to a farmer's market and so on, you could get double the value of your SNAP benefits if you were buying fresh fruits and vegetables. And then we've now expanded that in the 2018 bill, and it's now being used in a lot of grocery stores as well. So there's a lot of different pieces of this, and the food supply chain. We've, you know, during COVID, we've all seen the pictures where our dairy farmers who are selling to restaurants or big commercial operations were in a spot when those operations closed down where they were actually dumping milk. And we were all horrified because our food banks and our families need that, but they didn't have the way to change their supply chain to take it from big bulk, you know, containers down to a gallon jug of milk. So in the COVID bill, I also, for the first time, was able to get dollars to help our farmers be able to retool so that we can address, you know, the needs of hungry families and not have crops being piled under a melting dump.
Senator, we have less than a minute left. Just one more question. Given your expertise on food stamps, what is your sense of how far the $600 COVID relief payments that Congress passed will go? Do you foresee the Senate taking another look at larger payments in 2021?
Well, I think it's absolutely important that we have another survival package. When people talk about stimulus, this is actually survival. And I strongly support what our incoming president has pushed for, and colleagues have actually passed in the House a $2,000 payment for people to help them be able to get through this crisis. So it's going to take a number of things, help with small business, additional direct checks, food help, rental assistance, unemployment assistance. It's going to take a number of things, and we have to stay also laser focused on what we are doing to get the vaccines out and to make sure that people are safe.
Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. Senator, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you as usual.
Next up on the program, we speak with a presidential historian about this week's unprecedented events in Washington, D.C.
The behavior we saw a couple of days ago was the single most disruptive presidential act in U.S. history.
That's after a short break. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. After this unprecedented week of political violence, fueled by President Trump himself and followed by a flood of resignations from his own staff, we were wondering how history will remember these final days of the Trump presidency. Presidential historian Gleaves Whitney joins us now. He was the longtime director of the Hausenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. He now serves as executive director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation. Gleaves Whitney, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back.
Let's begin with a little late breaking news. President Trump tweeted today that he will not attend the inauguration. How many times has this happened before?
Well, it has happened occasionally where somebody has decided to, you know, to sort of boycott the inauguration. I know John Adams was pretty upset with Thomas Jefferson back in the election of 1800, inauguration of March of 1801. And it happens occasionally in U.S. history. But I think it's of a piece with, I don't think anybody would be surprised that Donald Trump would decide this. He continues to claim falsely that the election is illegitimate. So, you know, this is his exit. And frankly, I think it's fine. It will probably be less disruptive not to have him actually on the platform and having media interviews and that kind of thing.
Can you recall a less peaceful transfer of presidential power than what we're experiencing this year?
Well, you ask a great question. And we tend to forget that in U.S. history, we've had a lot of contentious elections in the past. The election of 1876, of course, where Rutherford B. Hayes ends up being the president. And then, of course, also the Civil War election, impending Civil War at 1860, in which Abraham Lincoln, his election spurred, of course, a lot of states all of a sudden to secede. So I don't want to say this is the worst, but I will say this. The behavior we saw a couple of days ago on Wednesday was the single most disruptive presidential act in U.S. history, where you had a sitting president incite a mob to violence and insurrection and to go in strength to the Capitol. Now, whether you're a Trump supporter or a Trump hater, I'm not here to encourage any side. I'm speaking in a nonpartisan fashion, but I am saying that that is a historic event. It will go down in the textbooks, as it should, as the single most disruptive act of a president of the United States. It has never happened before. We have had, of course, many instances in which strong disagreements resulted in partisan outrages. We've had people beat up, of course, on the floor of the House. We almost had fisticuffs the other night in the U.S. House, but I have never seen anything quite like what we saw on Wednesday in all of my study of history.
Gleaves, I think we need to just sit with this for a minute. Do you think it rises above the chaos that's been caused by assassinations in U.S. history?
In terms of the president himself precipitating the disruption, obviously when Kennedy was assassinated and other assassinations, but the presidents themselves were not precipitating the disruption. In terms of a president of his own volition going to talk to a crowd of people and inciting them to basically storm Capitol Hill and mount an insurrection, that's unique. I mean, as was rightly pointed out, we haven't seen anything like this since 1814, where the Capitol itself was invaded. And of course, those were foreigners. That was the British Army that invaded. These were our own people this time. These were American citizens, our brothers and sisters, who were misguided and who stormed the Capitol.
Do you have concerns about what future presidents may feel freed to do by the events of this week and indeed the last 4 years? Have we reached a new normal in how politics seeps into the precedence of the presidency?
Well, I'll tell you, there's something that happened that I want to mention, and I'll answer your question directly after I mention this. We need to be clear about who the revolutionary is here. It is certainly possible to make an argument that the progressives want to move us in, I would say, a revolutionary direction. And I respect people who have concerns. They make their argument in the marketplace of ideas. We listen. That's all legitimate. But let's be clear that it was Mr. Trump who was calling for revolutionary behavior when he was trying to negate the Electoral College by having the Congress decide who the slate of electors should be. The Congress, at his bidding, decide who was legitimate and illegitimate in counting of the electoral votes. That's the revolution that was happening on Tuesday and Wednesday, was that Congress would negate the role of the states in our federal system. That's what he was calling for. And I think we need to be clear about that. But here's the lesson. The Congress stood firm. The states, even the states run by Republican executives and having Republican majorities in their legislatures, often pushed back. The media were vigilant. I think that our American institutions showed on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday that they were resilient, they were strong, and that's perhaps the strongest signal we can send to any potential mischief in the future, unconstitutional activity in the future. Americans will not put up with that. The institutions prevailed. I mean, I'll be quite frank with you. I'm not always a fan of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in their roles in their leadership in the House and the Senate, respectively. But you know what? They did their constitutional duty yesterday, and they stood up to the president and they said, Cabinet, are you going to invoke the 25th Amendment? If you do not, we think the behavior of this president has been sufficient to start the proceedings for a re-impeachment. Well, those are institutional, lawful responses to what happened. That's what we're talking about here. Any future president who wants to do the same kinds of things that Mr. Trump has done will find our institutions are strong, they're resilient, and they will push back.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Gleaves Whitney. He's the executive director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation, formerly of Grand Valley State University. Gleaves, As you say, lawmakers are calling for the use of the 25th Amendment. First of all, would you review what the benchmark is for the 25th Amendment? What exactly has to be shown about the president's capacity?
And also, let me just preface anything more I say, and this would cover everything I've said up to this point. I am speaking in my private capacity as a citizen, and my views that I'm expressing on your show do not represent the views of the foundation, the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation itself. So I want viewers to know, if they want to hurl bricks at me, not to hurl them at the foundation, but at me. You know,
of course. We called you for your scholarly expertise.
Okay. Well, the 25th Amendment sets up, of course, President Ford was the first vice president and president installed under the terms of the 25th Amendment. It is invoked when there is either a crisis in the presidency itself, where the president is either too ill or regarded as incapacitated physically or perhaps mentally or behaviorally, and no longer fit to serve as president. And the 25th Amendment comes out of the assassination, the sad day, November 22nd, 1963, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and our lawmakers got together and they said, we really need to provide a mechanism for always having the orderly transfer of power, constitutional means. So it was ratified, I believe, in 1967, so 4 years after Kennedy was assassinated. But that was the precipitating event behind the 25th Amendment, always to have an orderly transfer of power and the ability to select a new vice president should the vice president advance to the presidency. So we're now at a point where the discussion, as you know, is, has President Trump's behavior shown evidence of a lack of fitness to hold the office, either because it's erratic or there is a question of mental competence or emotional stability to perform the duties of the presidency? I'm not in a position to judge those questions. I'll leave it to your listeners to come to their own conclusions about Trump's behavior. But the point is, it's constitutional. It is the regular method for the orderly transfer of power to the vice president, should it be necessary. And that's the thing that we need to respect through this whole process. Not lawlessness, not mobs, but the constitutional provisions we have at our disposal as Americans to keep democracy's greatest country going in an orderly manner.
I believe Gerald Ford is the only president to take office as a result of the 25th Amendment, correct?
That's correct. In 1974, upon Nixon's resignation, it was clear that President Ford, who had not been elected to be vice president, he had not been elected to be president. He became the first president in American history not elected by the people, who served in both of those capacities. And you know the rest of that story. He served, and then he ran, of course, on his own in 1976 for his own first term, and did not quite make it to the White House that way. He had to leave the White House in January 20th, 1977. And, you know, he served with dignity in his 3 years in office.
The most recent cabinet resignation is Education Secretary and our fellow Michigander, Betsy DeVos. How common are end-of-term resignations?
They're not that common. Or the reason for end-of-term resignations is that people start getting jobs. I mean, they go, often people, let's be frank about this, often people who serve in the cabinet are fairly well-to-do. They have some means, and they don't necessarily need to be in a cabinet position. But there are people also who do not come from, say, an entrepreneurial background, or they're not, you know, people who've acquired a lot of wealth, and they frankly need to find a job. Well, that's clearly not the case with Betsy DeVos. She comes from a West Michigan family, two families that have provided considerable means to the family. So she served as an active public service in the Trump administration. She's always had a natural passion for education. So you have to just sort of take all the factors, and that would give you an idea of perhaps what motivated her, and of course her words too, to resign. But it's, you know, people want to move on with their lives. When you have a lame duck president, he's going to be going out. People often decide that it's time to move on to, you know, because they can contribute at a higher level. That actually often happens.
If Betsy DeVos does step down right now, and if the president's cabinet were to invoke the 25th Amendment, it certainly seems like Betsy DeVos would not be obliged to take part in a vote to remove the president from office. Can we assume that that's part of the math here?
Well, I don't want to get into anybody's specific motives because I've not had any private correspondence with Secretary DeVos to confirm that kind of thinking. But, you know, when Elaine Chao, Betsy DeVos, it's been commented that by resigning, then they would not be party to any vote in the 25th Amendment to remove a president from constitutional office. So, you know, it would be unfair to the individuals involved for me to speculate. I'm sure when this question comes up, some people will have that calculus in their mind, and we will know later the extent to which, when they write their memoirs or their articles in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, their op-eds, we will know the extent to which it actually played a part in their decision-making.
Gleaves, how do you think the history books are going to write about what's happening right now?
Oh, this is, as an historian, I saw immediately the gravity of what was happening. And it really, I think it started when the transcript from last Saturday, it hasn't even been a week, what a week it's been, the transcript of the call with the Georgia Secretary of State, Raffensperger, came out. I had friends of mine who were highly supportive of Trump. They were calling just to inquire, you know, what to make of this. And I said, well, I think we have to be clear that this is a coup, in a sense, against our federalist system, and history must record it as such. The audacity, the brazenness to nullify the role of the states in our election, that is a serious problem. You can't have a president do that, try to do that unilaterally, and bully his vice president into changing the results, not only of the states, but then of the Congress, accepting and counting the slate of electors that the states send to Congress. That is a sacred federalist principle. The national government should not be party to that. So this was a serious offense. It was unconstitutional. It probably, I mean, when the way I interpret it, maybe I'm wrong, but I read the transcripts and I interpret the tone, listening to the president's conversation with the Georgia Secretary of State, it sounded like, find me 11,000 votes. Can't do that in our system. It's wrong.
What do you think historians will ultimately say about the outcome of the 2020 election?
That the United States proved to be an amazingly strong, resilient democracy. Our institutions worked. The Constitution has remained intact. The delicate federalist system that we have that balances power between the national government and the states worked when even people of the president's own party in the executive branch of state government and the legislative branches of state government pushed back. And they said, no, this is not going to happen. I think that will be the most impressive thing down the road that our historians will be writing about. But I always caution, you know, it takes 50 years, believe it or not, it takes 50 years, according to most historians, to really evaluate an event and to get all those memoirs, diaries, all the commentary out there. And we always have to wait to see what happens in the next administration to put this administration in context. You asked a question that was very suggestive earlier. Will a future president take the worst parts of the Trump presidency and his personal behavior and try to imitate it? We'll see if a future president does so. That will also cast light on what happened from Saturday to Thursday of this week.
I have to ask you, you came to this job as director of the Gerald Ford Presidential Foundation relatively recently, toward the end of 2020. There was this moment on Wednesday when the Trump supporters who broke into the Capitol hung the Trump campaign flag on the statue of Jerry Ford that is in the Capitol building, and they stuck a MAGA hat on his head. How would that have sat with our 38th president?
Well, I've been asked this by a number of people and also other interviews, and I got to tell you, President Ford would be heartbroken at what happened from this period, say, Saturday through Wednesday and Thursday. And there is no question that he would have been outraged that a hooligan would have climbed his statue, mounted his statue under the rotunda there of the Capitol, put a flag in his arm and put a hat on his head that would be questionable at best whether he would have endorsed the values of such flag and hat. President Ford, remember, was somebody who respected our Constitution, our institutions. He was somebody who believed it was necessary to reach across the aisle to people with whom you disagree. We're all in this marriage as American citizens together. We got to make it work. It's not an easy marriage. It's a tough marriage. Sometimes we want to divorce each other. But you know what? We're here. We're in it. We got to make it work, and we've got to do it without coming to blows. So many of the values that President Ford has held dear, the values of civility and decency and knowing the right thing to do without resorting to a poll, those values were violated by that mob that stormed the rotunda and the rest of the Capitol, and they were violated by the hooligan who mounted his statue and put that flag in his arm and a hat on his head. Terrible, disappointing, outrageous.
Gleaves Whitney is executive director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation, formerly with the Housenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. Gleaves, thank you so much. What a strange moment. Thanks for helping us interpret it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I always love your show. You guys do a great job.
Next up, we'll talk more about Betsy DeVos, her decision to step away as education secretary, and what might be next for her.
She wanted to fundamentally change how education is done in this country, and that's what she spent the last 4 years doing.
That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last night, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos became the second cabinet member to resign from Donald Trump's administration. Betsy DeVos played a key role in pushing the expansion of school choice and charter school policies in Michigan, and her ascension to the cabinet was a huge victory for advocates seeking to shake up the American system of traditional education. She has also been a hugely controversial figure. There's no love lost between DeVos and most teachers and administrators in traditional public schools. It's going to take more than a day to process her time in Washington, but we're starting now with David Jesse. He covers higher education for the Detroit Free Press and also was on the K-12 beat for a good deal of DeVos's Michigan career. David Jesse, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me back.
So I think the question on a lot of people's minds for these post-insurrection resignations is, why now? Do you have thoughts about that?
She was very clear last night that she didn't agree with the rhetoric and the driving of the folks, the mob, to the Capitol that she believes traces directly back to Donald Trump. There's questions about timing. Like you said, there's some who wonder, you know, about the whole 25th Amendment issue. Would she have voted? Did she want to avoid a vote on a 25th? Elizabeth Warren had tweeted something about DeVos was getting out because she didn't want to vote on the 25th. And Betsy responded and said, not true at all. So I think that's one of the questions that a lot of folks have, not only for her, but for other cabinet members, other members of this administration that are leaving now at the last second. Why, with a week or two left, are you leaving? Why not last month? Why not 2 years ago? Why even join the administration at the beginning?
Yeah. From the very beginning, Betsy DeVos was a target of intense criticism as Secretary of Education, from teachers' unions, from public school administrators. Tell us a bit about how her approach differed from past education secretaries.
Betsy DeVos has always been a very conservative person who has very definite views about education, and no state knows that more than Michigan. My wife and I were talking last night how we both covered her when we worked in Holland at the Holland Sentinel 2 decades ago, and her drive for choice, for charter schools, for vouchers, and she brought all that with her to the federal post, to the secretary's job. She wanted to change how education is done in this country, and that's what she spent the last 4 years doing. And that's hugely controversial. As you said, the teachers' union hated it. You know, the teacher union had last night, when news broke, tweeted 2 words in response to the resignation: good riddance.
Ouch.
So you know, she brought what she has been doing here in Michigan for the last two decades to Washington and just continued along that same path.
What do you see as some of her major accomplishments in Washington?
You know, she did what she set out to do. You know, last night she said she's proud of her efforts to expand school choice. She backed the federal government out of a lot of stuff. She changed the rules on how colleges and universities handle campus sexual assault, a huge topic of interest here in Michigan, where we have two universities, Michigan State and the University of Michigan, struggling in recent years with sexual assault. So she, you know, she really took that conservative agenda towards education and implemented it. She rolled back, as she said she would, a lot of the stuff that had been done under President Obama and his Secretary of Education. So in that way, she accomplished a lot of what she set out to do.
Yeah. You noted that one of the things that Betsy DeVos did was change the game on how campus sexual assault is treated and investigated. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Why were the changes she made so significant? And what are advocates and survivors saying about the work that she did?
So the big changes are the implementation, the requirement now that there be a hearing, a live hearing that almost resembles a court hearing when there's an accusation. Beforehand, universities, I'd report that there was a sexual assault. The university would have its investigators look into it, issue a report, but there would not be any back and forth. There'd be no direct cross-examination of witnesses. And so a lot of folks pushed for the opportunity for someone who had been accused to question, to provide their own witnesses, to kind of make their argument in a more clear way. That matches, by the way, what the federal courts have been doing. On the flip side, those who have undergone sexual assault say this will have the effect of just shrinking the number of people who want to come forward. If you know you're going to have to face your accuser in some sort of way or have your story questioned and picked apart, you know, that can add a lot of trauma to this horrible situation. And so they're afraid that that will just mean that people will just not report, that they'll just be quiet and we'll go back to the way it used to be when stuff got swept under the rug.
This week, DeVos sent a letter to Congress urging them to block the Biden administration's education agenda. David, what do you expect we'll see from the incoming president and his team? Do you think they'll try to roll back what Betsy DeVos rolled back or take some other actions?
I think you'll see a lot of attempt to roll back things, including we just talked about the sexual assaults on campus and how that guidance is now in place. I think you'll see, you know, there's a lot of talk about free college, about some of those issues. I think you'll see some of the school choice stuff that she put in place rolled back. The real question is, how much are they going to be able to get through? The Democrats do have control of the House and the Senate. The Senate's very tight. Are there conservative Democrats in the Senate who might be pro-school choice, for example, that would make it hard for President Biden and his team to roll back some of the charter school stuff? I think it's going to be a very interesting and very telling what pops up in the first month or two from the administration as to what fights they're willing to have. I know that the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, has a long list of things they want to be attacked. I'm not certain that President Biden is ready for all those fights.
Betsy DeVos was a known quantity in Michigan, particularly to folks who work in education when she went to Washington. But her ascent to the cabinet level put her in a position to become kind of a villain to many progressives across the country. And not just because she was working for Donald Trump, but because of some of the priorities that she set. Do you see her being able to jump back into the world of Michigan politics in the same role that she had before after all this?
I think she will. Her family, her organizations have not left Michigan politics. You know, the PACs, the political action committees, the influence she has. And remember that Michigan is still generally, in the legislature at least, pretty conservative. And she has a great deal of influence and still will have a great deal of influence on education policy in Michigan through those legislators. And remember, a lot of what she wanted to accomplish in Michigan, she has accomplished. And so it's in place. We have charter schools. We have wide choice. And so I think she's still going to have a very prominent, a prominent role. I don't think you can overlook the fact that she, you know, still has has a lot of money to give, a lot of favors to call in, and that buys you a seat at the table.
David Jesse of the Detroit Free Press. David, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Betsy DeVos has been a fairly private figure, and questions about what make her tick remain throughout her tenure as Secretary of Education. Why would someone who does not really relish the limelight take such a public-facing job? Here to help us better understand is Greg McNeely. He's worked with Betsy DeVos in several capacities over the years, including as her confirmation manager after she was nominated by President Trump. Greg McNeely, welcome to Stateside.
Happy to be here.
How did Betsy DeVos become interested in education issues to begin with?
Betsy has always been a lifelong learner herself, and her mother was a public school teacher. So I think it's always been a part of the sort of the fabric of her environment. But the issue that has really animated or motivated her has been education choice or school choice. And that occurred when she started having kids of her own that would go to schools. And she started noticing that the choices she was able to make were different than maybe her neighbors could make. And that sort of, you know, led to the series of questions anybody would have. And what drives this? And it's a pretty short distance to the answer that it's public policy.
She then takes this high scrutiny, low pay cabinet position. Why did she decide to say yes to the cabinet job?
It's a great question, and one that surprised many, because at the 2016 Republican National Convention in Cleveland, she did not endorse Donald Trump. She was a John Kasich delegate and did not vote for Donald Trump at the convention. She was offered the position because she became to the president's attention as an advocate for school choice. And when he offered it to her, I think she had some reluctance because of what the country had experienced to that point with the president, the campaign, but then was struck by the opportunity to really make a difference. If you want a platform, being a cabinet secretary is certainly something that provides you a bit of a microphone. And she received a lot of advice from people that she respected, governors, former governors, U.S. senators, that were like, you know, this is an opportunity. You can really, really advance an issue as well as fix a department that has a lot of issues and struggles. And so I think it was a bit of a wrestle, but she decided to do it. I don't think she fully comprehended the scrutiny part of which rapidly or very quickly became apparent.
What do you know about why this week was the breaking point for Betsy DeVos with the Trump administration?
Well, and let me be clear, I do not, and nor have I ever been a spokesperson for the Department of Education or for Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary, and I'm not speaking on her behalf. But in reading her letter of resignation, it's very clear that this was an issue that was sort of a final straw. And if you go back through her tenure, you'll see that she publicly had some disagreements with him. She disagreed, for instance, the way some of the language he would use, and admonished him publicly for it, thought some of his foul language was inappropriate for a president who is often watched by school children. She had a difference of agreement with him over a budget proposal he had with special education. So she was not unaccustomed to having conflicts with him. But when you're in a cabinet, you work for the president. Just like any person who has an employer, that's part of your job. You don't always agree with everything. But what we witnessed this week was somebody that had created an environment that now has a body count, very tragically. And that environment was the telling of a fiction and a fantasy that gave people a wrong set of assumptions, using militaristic language to incite them, to fuel them. It's akin to somebody that would gather a bunch of dry tinling, pour gasoline on it, and set a box of matches out. Now, they don't strike the match, but they clearly have moral culpability. And no doubt in reading the secretary's letter that was weighing heavily upon her mind. And, you know, if you look at the timing of the letter and when she made her choice, it looks to me like the cabinet had concluded that they weren't going to make any substantial changes. And so I think that was the only option she saw.
I have to note that in stepping down, Betsy DeVos would not be taking part in any cabinet action to invoke the 25th Amendment. Just to push back a little bit, there is one other option that they have to try to remove the president from office.
Well, just to clarify that, though, at 4 o'clock yesterday, a news outlet broke a news story that has since been robustly confirmed in that the vice president has taken the 25th Amendment off the table. You cannot do the 25th Amendment option without a vice president willing to serve in that role.
So you think that might have been a factor that she at least was aware of?
I can only look at the chronology in the timing and say that that seems to be a logical conclusion.
Back in December, Betsy DeVos was in a meeting with Department of Ed employees in which she talked about what was going to happen in the coming months as Joe Biden takes office as president. And she said, be the resistance. She was talking to her employees, be the resistance against forces that will derail you from doing what's right for students. In everything you do, please put students first, always. And it kind of took some people aback. What do you think she meant by that? What do you think she's worried about?
And thank you for asking that question and reading the full quote, because many outlets chose to reframe that and write a headline that said that Betsy DeVos said to resist the Biden administration. That's not what that quote says. That quote very clearly says and is encouraging the department to do what's in the best interest of students. I think her comment, that quote you just read, should be something that there ought to be almost universal bipartisan agreement about. That education ought to be primarily and mostly about the person that's supposed to benefit, the student. I think that there is a difference in those who are practitioners in the education system, the professional adults, the hardworking teachers out there who have given their life, service, and dedication to help students, that sometimes what's best for the teacher is not best for the student. And what's best for the student sometimes may not be best for the teacher. And where in that conflict arises, I believe that Betsy believes, and I personally know that I believe, it's always right to do what's in the best interest of the children.
Over the years, Betsy DeVos has faced some criticism about, having a patrician background and the perception that she's removed from the lives of average Americans. Do you think she could have done a different job of communicating with people about who she is and what she was trying to do?
I do. I absolutely do. How effective it would have been probably is a robust question for public relations specialists to debate, because it is who she is. It's not her whole story. I mean, she was born and raised in a 900 square foot house. And so she has a very diverse background, but it is who she is. But could she have done more in that regard? I think so. And I do believe it would have been potentially helpful in allowing more people to hear her. We do have a crisis of class consciousness in this country where it's a bit of us versus them. And you get a lot of assumptions and biases and prejudice that creep into people's perceptions when they hear people from a different class having a conversation. That's unfortunate. And one of the ways to break that down is literally by breaking bread with people of all sorts of diverse backgrounds. But could she have done more as a secretary to maybe breach that divide? I think so. I don't know how effective it would have been, but I think more effort could have been helpful.
Greg McNeely, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
There is so much more to talk about with respect to Betsy DeVos's work. We want you to know we'll be having those conversations next week. And that's Stateside for today. Gotta say, 2021, you're already killing us. I'm April Baer. We'll see you next week. Take care.